It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the latest from the Democratic National Convention with Harry Enten of 538.
First, back in April of 2015, news came out that 25-year-old Freddie Gray had died in police custody in Baltimore. At the time, it was the latest in a series of controversial deaths of black men at the hands of police.
Six officers were originally charged with various offenses related to the incident after a medical examination proved that Gray's death from a spinal injury was not accidental. Three officers have already been acquitted. And news broke today that the charges would be dropped against the remaining officers.
Joining us now to talk about the news is Kenneth Burns. He's a reporter at WYPR, the public radio station in Baltimore. He's been covering this case over the last year. Kenneth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
What did we hear today about why the charges were dropped against the remaining officers?
There was not much said in court. The lead prosecutors, the prosecutors for the last four trials, I should say, Chief Deputy State's Attorney Michael Schatzo and State's Attorney Janice Bledsoe, they asked the they made a motion before the judge to drop the charges against the remaining three officers. To kind of set it up, today was supposed to be pretrial motions and a hearing for Officer Garrett Miller, the fifth officer who would be brought to trial in this case. And we were supposed to have a different set of prosecutors. So there was a little bit of surprise when we saw Schatzo and Bledsoe sitting at their table in the courtroom as we have for the past few months. And once they started dropping charges, it became quite clear that the state's attorney has decided to move on.
And some of the thinking, I think, has been that given that previous officers in trials have been acquitted, the idea was that the bar was really going to be high. It was going to be really difficult for prosecutors to make charges stick at this point based on what they'd seen so far.
Exactly. And we've seen the prosecution use the same theory over and over again. Freddie Gray was killed because they didn't put him in a seatbelt in the back of this police van, and that they neglected to follow the orders that were updated days before Freddie Gray was even arrested. And so they applied that theory to all of these officers, and the judge simply each time in each of the last three verdicts, he decided them that they did not present any evidence to show that they were criminally liable. They might have broken the department policy, but as far as their intent or in terms of that department policy, that's up to the police department. But as far as the criminal charges, they're not criminally responsible for many reasons, one of which a police general order, which is the same as the company policy. You cannot be held criminally responsible if you break a company rule.
As I understand it, a medical examiner said this death wasn't a suicide, wasn't an accident. It was a homicide, but no one individually, it looks like, will be responsible, will be legally accountable if this is a homicide.
That's correct. And during the trial of Officer Caesar Goodson, he was the van driver. It came to light that at one point the medical examiner did think about this incident being an accident, but she stood by her opinion that this was a homicide. From the state medical examiner's perspective, a homicide is just a decision. It means you died at the hands of somebody else. And she said the reason she called it a homicide is because no one called to get medical attention right away to Freddie Gray.
Talking to Kenneth Burns from WYPR, public radio in Baltimore, about the news today that the remaining officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray will not be charged, charges withdrawn against those officers after others had been acquitted. Let's hear from State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. She made a speech this morning after the charges were dropped. Here's part of what she had to say.
The decision to prosecute six police officers was not and has never been an indictment on the entire Baltimore Police Department. Although some have tried to invalidate my family's longstanding service as public officers, I know firsthand the sacrifices, the dedication, the commitment it takes to protect and serve our communities. For those that believe that I'm anti-police, it's simply not the case. I'm anti-police brutality, and I need not remind you that the only loss and the greatest loss in all of this was that of Freddie Gray's life.
Now, Kenneth, so Kenneth, this is a local story in Baltimore, but it's going on in the midst of the national Black Lives Matter campaign, arguments about worries over police-minority relationships in a lot of communities around the country. This comes the day after the group Mothers of the Movement spoke at the Democratic National Convention, highlighting issues of violence in communities. Talk about how all that has been playing out there in Baltimore.
Well, keep in mind, this case kind of, I don't want to say kick things off, but it was clearly the pressure point in this dialogue, right? And particularly in Baltimore, where we had previous incidents, Tyrone West in 2013, Anthony Anderson before them, Tyrone West. And so this case, if you think about it, comes after Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. It comes after the New York case. I'm blanking on the name
Garner.
Of that gentleman. Yes, the Garner case. So here we come to Baltimore with Freddie Gray, who died while in police custody. No one knows why, and it kind of kicks things over as far as the national conversation that seems to be growing and growing with other incidents, especially as of late, considering what happened in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and outside of St. Paul.
What's been reaction in Baltimore to this announcement today?
Well, I was at the news conference with Marilyn Mosby, and you have residents. And by the way, let me back up for a second. This news conference takes place on the block where Freddie Gray was initially detained by officers more than a year ago. And so you have residents of Gilmore Homes, which is a housing project, as well as other West Baltimore residents who kind of heard something was taking place. They cheered her as she made her way to the podium, supported her. They gave applause as she was making her points. So they were happy that somebody did something in regards to holding police officers accountable, but at the same time, they're disappointed that none of these officers will be punished. They feel that once again the system is rigged against everyday citizens in that part of Baltimore.
Now, there's a mayoral election. We're in the midst of that in Baltimore. The Democratic primary has already happened. I understand that's the main event, actually, even though there's an election in November. What are things looking like politically on these issues looking ahead?
Well, as you said, the Democratic primary is pretty much the main show. Generally, the general election in Baltimore is a mere formality. So there will not be any political fallout as in regards to what happens as a result of these cases. Marilyn Mosby's not up for re-election until 2018. The current mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, she's not seeking re-election. So when December comes around, she's out the door, and then we're going to have effectively a brand new city council. More than half the seats changed over during the primary because they were either unopposed or they faced weak competition.
I understand the federal government was looking into the workings of the Baltimore Police Department, as they have done reviewing police departments around the country. Do you know where that is now?
The last I heard, they were in the final stages of that, and this was the result of a request made by Mayor Rawlings-Blake. She asked for a collaborative review, which is when the police department and the federal government kind of work together. But after the Freddie Gray incident, that's when the Justice Department decided to upgrade things to a civil rights or what they call a pattern or practice investigation through the Baltimore Police Department. They have been active over the last year. And as far as the final stages, that's the last I heard, but when they will release their final report, they have not made that public yet.
What's the mood like in Baltimore? And I know it depends on who you ask, probably, but are things viewed as really difficult and fraught right now between the police department and communities there in the city?
No. The best way I could describe it is as a period before Freddie Gray was arrested. Of course, the incident happened, but as far as the distrust of some citizens, particularly in that part of West Baltimore where the incident took place, that's still there. The police department, they have a new commissioner. The original commissioner during the incident, Anthony Best, was fired last year. He's doing what he can to kind of balance between the two. He's trying to say, we're going to reach out to the community and try to heal things. And he also criticized the FOP at some time ago, shortly after one of the trials, when they sent some tweets that were roundly criticized.
We'll leave it there, Kenneth. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kenneth Burns, reporter with WYPR in Baltimore. He joined us to talk about the news out of Baltimore today that all remaining charges against the officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray would be dropped. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll meet a candidate in next month's congressional primary as part of our series of Wisconsin candidate interviews.
Right now, we're recapping day two of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Last night, we heard from the delegates.
Madam Secretary, Arizona cast 34 votes for Senator Sanders.
And 51 votes for the next president of the United States of America, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
That was the Arizona delegation taking the floor, pledging their votes, including at the end their 102-year-old Jerry Emmett, who was old enough to remember when women weren't allowed to vote.
The Sanders camp determines where to go from here after their candidate symbolically cast his vote for Hillary Clinton.
And Donald Trump is getting a lot of criticism after apparently encouraging Russia to look for the missing emails that have been dogging the Hillary Clinton campaign.
It's time for a weekly check-in with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He's in Philadelphia this week covering the convention. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Going to start off with the big news. Hillary Clinton now officially the Democratic nominee for president.
What an incredible honor that you have given me. And I can't believe we just put the biggest crack in that glass ceiling yet. Thanks to you and to everyone who's fought so hard to make this possible. This is really your victory. This is really your night. And if there are any little girls out there who stayed up late to watch, let me just say, I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next. Thank you all. I can't wait to join you in Philadelphia. Thank you.
Hillary Clinton making a surprise appearance at the end of the night last night via a video feed, something like that. Harry, what's been the reaction to this nomination?
I think, you know, on Monday there was some negativity around the convention with the Bernie Sanders delegation in California booing. But last night it was really Hillary Clinton's night as Bill Clinton gave the primetime major address. And then obviously Hillary Clinton accepted the nomination. I would say, look, Democrats are enthused. I think that they're worried by some of the polling numbers that have been coming out. But they're generally enthused. This is a generally favorable crowd to Hillary Clinton so far.
A party coming out of a convention wants this rah-rah happy message with good visuals coming out of it. Both parties had rocky starts and some down moments. Are Democrats getting out there what they want to get out there at this point after that rocky start?
Yeah, I think so. Look, Bill Clinton, people say that last night perhaps wasn't his greatest speech, but Bill Clinton, even on a subpar night, is still better than 99% of the population at trying to excite people. I would say, yeah, they're getting the message that they want out so far. The real question is whether or not the American public wants to hear that message, you know. But we won't know that for a few days yet. But generally speaking, the delegates here seem to be enthusiastic, and they certainly were last night. I was in the hall when Bill Clinton spoke. The speech played very well with those delegates.
There was some interesting back and forth on the news networks last night digesting Bill Clinton's speech. Some people saying, you know, maybe he shouldn't have framed it in terms of his romantic relationship with Hillary Clinton. Other people saying, well, but it painted this picture of why she got into politics in the first place. It humanized her. What were you hearing yesterday?
Well, yeah, I heard the exact same split. I mean, if you watch, for instance, on MSNBC, there was a major split between Rachel Maddow and Chuck Todd, with Rachel Maddow saying that she didn't like the speech and Chuck was basically disagreeing with her. Most of the delegates seemed to be very enthused by the Clinton speech, but, you know, obviously delegates are not a random percentage of the population. They are very specific people. They really like Democrats, and most of them really like Hillary Clinton. But, you know, the one thing that's interesting to me is I think Bill Clinton was trying to play the role of being the first man And usually first ladies talk about their spouses and how they met them, and I think that was what Bill Clinton was trying to do. Whether or not it played like that or played perhaps to be a little sexist, I can't answer that question. But it seemed to me that Bill Clinton was merely giving a speech that you'd expect from somebody who is the spouse of the presidential nominee.
Senator Bernie Sanders spoke this week, and he led off the nomination process. Let's give a listen.
Madam Chair, I move that the convention suspend the procedural rules. I move that all votes cast by delegates be reflected in the official record. And I move that Hillary Clinton be selected as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
Harry, we've heard Bernie Sanders making the rounds of the delegation breakfast for various states, trying to encourage his supporters to get on board with the Hillary Clinton campaign. We've talked about this a lot in the past with you, Harry, but from what you're seeing at the convention, is he making a persuasive case for some of his biggest holdouts there?
Well, I do know I spoke with two delegates from the California delegation earlier today. If you remember, on Monday, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation, the California delegation was one of the most vocal in booing on Monday. And the two delegates from the California delegation were behind Hillary Clinton. They obviously wish that Bernie Sanders was the nominee. But, you know, look, Bernie Sanders has been around the block. He's someone who understands politics. He understands that if it's not Hillary Clinton who's going to win, it's going to be Donald Trump. And more delegates than not here who are Bernie Sanders supporters are behind Hillary Clinton. There are going to be a few holdouts, as I expect, in the general election as well among the general population. But we'll wait and see whether Bernie Sanders, giving an enthusiastic endorsement of Clinton over the past few weeks, is able to bring those at least a good portion of those wayward Sanders supporters back into the Democratic tent.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now from 538.com. Harry's covering the Democratic National Convention this week in Philadelphia. And Harry, I wonder, it's midweek, do you have any compare and contrasting to do between the Republican National Convention and the Democratic in what you're seeing in the tone among the delegates and the way that the whole thing is coming off as a spectacle on TV? How's it working?
Sure. I mean, there are multiple different things that are occurring. Number one, there are more delegates at a Democratic convention than a Republican convention. So I think it's obviously a much more vocal crowd here. And I think that comes across on television. It certainly comes across in the hall. I would also say that there are a lot of delegates here who are scared. And when they look at the polls and see Donald Trump ahead, and it's scared in a different way that people are scared in Cleveland. I think both sides had fear. But it's a different type of fear, with the Cleveland being, you know, not afraid of what might happen, but of what is happening in the country, while the delegates here in Philadelphia think the direction of the country is pretty good and are much more fearful of what might happen if Donald Trump gets elected. But I'd say, you know, overall, the delegates on both sides seem to be equally behind their presidential nominees.
Let's touch on the polling for a moment, Harry. You've been writing Donald Trump had his convention and that post-convention bounce. Where are things looking before we see what the Democratic convention does to the polls?
Right. So right now, you know, if you're looking at the polls at this exact moment in time, Donald Trump is either about tied or perhaps slightly ahead of Hillary Clinton. Of course, that is generally to be expected when you go into a convention down 3 points. It shouldn't be surprising to you based upon history to get a 3-point convention bounce. I think that there were some people who thought, oh, it was such a mess in Cleveland that maybe Trump will get a negative bounce. But usually candidates get bounces, and Trump got one. The question is whether Hillary Clinton gets a bounce, and we won't know that for at least a couple of days.
And looking at Donald Trump right now, we've seen the fallout continuing still with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the WikiLeaks about the emails involving her and maybe a bias against Bernie Sanders early on. And Donald Trump at a news conference today, it was today, appealed to a foreign power for help during the election.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
So, Harry, the clip from today, what do you make of that?
I mean, what else is there really to say about Donald Trump and what he has said so far? Any other candidate who would have made that statement that you just played right there would be dead in the water and would have to walk out with his tail between his legs and get beat in November by 10 to 15 points. But Donald Trump has said any number of things during this campaign that sound ridiculous on their face, and yet he seems to do perfectly fine. Again, this is not something that would be typical of a presidential nominee, but when Trump says it, apparently the American public seems to be okay with it.
And Democrats have jumped on that statement and others related and others kind of backing that up later. And we've seen a spokesperson for Paul Ryan also condemn this statement, say Putin, Russia should stay out of the American election. Is this one of those things that causes some cringing among the Republican establishment, people who have somewhat unwillingly in some cases come to support Donald Trump in this race?
Of course it does. I mean, this is, as I was basically saying, this is just not something that's usual. You don't call upon Russia especially to start releasing data and trying to hurt one of the presidential candidates, especially data that was stolen, essentially. And I think, you know, Republicans will condemn it like Paul Ryan, but at the end of the day, condemning only gets you so far. If you're going to continue to support Donald Trump, as they are doing, there's no sign they're not going to do it. Words don't speak as loud as actions, and the actions of the Republican National Committee and the Republican leaders besides Donald Trump indicate that they're as behind him as ever.
And Harry, as we wrap up, what are you looking for in the next couple of days at the DNC this week?
I think that there are two things I'm looking for. Tonight, I'm looking forward to see whether Joe Biden or Barack Obama really brings it to Trump to make the case against Donald Trump. We saw a lot of negativity in Cleveland, not nearly as much so far in Philadelphia. I expect to see some of that. I also expect to see Hillary Clinton try and bring up her likability numbers tomorrow night, her trustworthy numbers. People just don't like her. She's going to try and tell her story and bring her favorables up. We'll see if she's able to do it.
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. He joins us every week at this time to talk about the latest in national politics and the presidential race. This week, he joined us from Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention.
Coming up after the news, we continue our series of candidate interviews and one of the Democrats looking to challenge incumbent congressional representative Glenn Grothman. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out why people at the Wisconsin Delegates Breakfast booed U.S. Representative Ron Kind.
First, we continue our series of candidate interviews for next month's primary elections here in Wisconsin. We've invited candidates in contested congressional primaries to join us here on Central Time and on the Joy Cardine Show.
Today, we turn to the 6th Congressional District. The district sprawls from Sheboygan and Manitowoc on the shores of Lake Michigan through Fond du Lac and Oshkosh and west to include parts of Columbus and Wisconsin Dells.
Republican Glenn Grothman is the incumbent. Two Democrats are running to challenge him, Michael Slattery and Sarah Lloyd.
The winner of the primary on Tuesday, August 9th, will be on the ballot in November, facing Grothman and independent candidate Jeff Dahlke.
Michael Slattery joins us now. He's a candidate in the Democratic primary for the 6th Congressional District. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us in our studio in Green Bay. Well, tell us, first of all, why are you running for Congress?
Okay, I'm running for a number of reasons. One is we have paralysis and we have inaction in Washington. Really nothing is getting done. I come out of business, and in business, I needed to produce, and I needed to produce on time and meet deadlines, and that's not happening. Another reason that I'm running is I spent roughly 13 years in a religious order in the Catholic Church called the Jesuits, and what I learned in that was basically three things. One is focus on those who are marginalized or those who are poor. Second, service to others. And third, act on social justice. And that is what I seek to do. I seek to be a service to people, and I seek to address those who are marginalized and on the peripheries of society. That's my objective.
Can you tell us more about your background and why it prepares you to represent your district in Congress?
Yes, be happy to. So, as I said, I was in the Jesuits for 13 years, and that prepared me for working in service to others, not for myself. And what I've learned on this campaign is the campaign isn't about me. It's like what Sanders says. This is a movement. This is coming together to align with people that have shared values, shared principles, shared goals, with expectations for execution on those. And so I really am about serving others. Then I, for the past 17 years with my wife, we've farmed. And we are the real farmers. I mean, we don't talk about farming. We're out there every day farming. And we raise Holstein steers and cash crop grain and commercial vegetables. And for the Farmers Union, of which I was a principal for 5 years, I've written like 2/3 of all their new policy. So I understand farming to great depths and comprehensively. The next point that prepares me for running a campaign to work in Washington is I worked in business. I worked in the World Trade Center in New York for 12 years, and I worked in Tokyo for 6 years for the U.S. largest finance company. What did I learn in those? I learned business discipline, and that's certainly what we are lacking in Washington. And by the business discipline, I learned finance comprehensively. I learned the how to analyze the level and the capacity for a country to assume debt and to what level. I learned municipal finance, for which I financed 3 or 4 different projects over a period of 2 years. So I think that prepares me for working on the national stage as well as the international stage to represent the people of this district.
In this primary race, you and Sarah Lloyd have been described by one paper as friendly rivals. You agree on a lot of issues. How would you distinguish yourself from your opponent in this primary for voters?
Okay, so I've known Sarah for 8 years, and personally we're friends. We're both very active in the Farmers Union. She's worked part-time, and I was on the board running the state organization. The difference between Sarah and myself are a number of points. One is expertise and experience. So working in business in New York or in Tokyo, I ran businesses. For example, I got the this bank, the large Japanese bank that I work for in the Trade Center in New York, I got them into the municipal finance business. I represented all the Japanese banks in 4 Latin American countries during the debt restructuring exercises that went on for 10 years. Did project finance, regulatory reporting, as well as strategic planning for finance. So I understand finance from a whether it's banking or whether it's investment banking or whether it's asset management or whether it's insurance. I've been involved in all of those. Then when I went to Japan, sent there by to start operations for the U.S. largest finance company, I started an asset management company for them and ran it, bought the 11th largest life insurance company in Japan for them, or at least initiated the project where it was bought. It's getting things done on a national and international level. Those are the biggest differences. I would also say is that my wife and I, we are the actual farmers. I mean, I'm out there raising cattle, loading steers, for which I got my teeth knocked in April while I was shipping them, planting crops, harvesting, doing the hedging, whether it's in the futures market or forward market, things like that. So I'm a person of experience, and I'm a person that does things. Those are the biggest differences.
Talking to Michael Slattery, Democratic congressional candidate in the 6th District primary. Michael, if you were to win the primary election, you'd face off against Republican incumbent Glenn Grothman. What would you focus in on that race? More probably compare and contrast with him than your primary opponent.
Okay, so first of all, I'm sure you're well aware, as well as the listeners, that this is a very difficult, very Republican district. No Democrat has won here since 1964, and it was only for one term. So how would I approach Mr. Grothman, who I will treat civilly? I would approach him on a number of issues that I feel he has shorted the public on. One of which is, the first thing is, he says he is pro-life. But really, if you're pro-life, you know, pro-life means more than just anti-abortion. It means opposing excessive military expenditure that we have, working for the Veterans Affairs, It means paying a living wage. It means imposing capital punishment. It means affordable housing. It means health care for all. It means supporting those who are marginalized in society, some of which are undocumented people who have lived here for several generations. So that's the first thing. Second thing, he focuses on his interest and concern for seniors. But he's been in Washington now for a year and a half, and the Republicans, they've been in control for, I guess, maybe close to 5 or 6 years now. But they haven't addressed this issue of shoring up the Social Security Trust Fund. Not an insurmountable problem. Third point is the issue of trade. Now, Mr. Grothman, he will support the interests of major corporations. But the interests of small corporations in trade and the interests of most farmers is not totally beneficial. There is no training, retraining for people if they lose their jobs, which they did after NAFTA. There was something like 780,000 people. They needed retraining and retraining to enter the 21st century. And I seek to represent the interests of small and mid-sized businesses, average-sized farmers, and those who are marginalized.
Republicans control the House, as you just mentioned. It seems like there's a good chance they'll control it again next year. If you're a Democrat in a Republican-controlled House of Representatives, how would you reach across the aisle to try to get some of your priorities enacted?
All right, so I am a person who works in business, and in business, I work very often with people who I thought maybe were morally reprehensible, who were unappealing in terms of a personality, who had character flaws that maybe bothered me. That doesn't matter. In business, what you need to do, you have a job, you need to get the job done, and you need to get it done on time. And so if I'm elected and if I am in a Republican-controlled House, makes no difference. I'm not really interested in partisan politics. I'm interested in serious issues that are confronting the public and confronting our society that need to be solved and not kicking the can down the road. We are just continuously kicking the can down the road that is irresponsible to our taxpayers, to our citizens. And I would definitely, I will look for people that have shared values, that wish to see various objectives attained. Work with those people, form alliances, and together, you don't do this by yourself, but together, advance various laws along.
We're talking to Michael Slattery, Democratic congressional candidate in Wisconsin's 6th District primary.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the candidate? What should Congress focus on next year? If you live in the 6th Congressional District, what's the most important issue in your area? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after this short break and get into some more of the issues with the candidate here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Michael Slattery. He's running in the Democratic congressional primary in Wisconsin's 6th District. The winner of that primary will challenge the incumbent Republican, Glenn Grothman.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for the candidate? If you live in the 6th District, what's the most important issue there? What are your top priorities for Congress next year? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to our callers, Michael, you mentioned the issue of trade. That's been a hot issue in this presidential campaign. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in particular in either party raising concerns about free trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What's your approach? What is your philosophy? What should we be doing?
Okay. When I worked for this Japanese bank in New York, I underwrote billions of dollars of trade all over the world, mostly Europe and Southeast Asia, Italy, Spain, as well as in Latin America. So I do support trade. Trade is beneficial. And the trade agreements that we have, do they increase trade with the country, either exports or imports? You bet they do. So, and as a farmer, what happens with, we're engaged in overproduction of particularly grains as well as various commodities, be it milk, what have you. How do we get rid of that? Well, we get rid of that partially through trade. Now then, if you're talking about the TPP or the TTIP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with Europe, which is still being negotiated, how do you look at that? I have two major problems, at least with TPP, what we know so far, and they are the following. First of all, corporations know what is in those treaties so far. They have lobbyists that have worked on them, yet our Congress people, they are unable under confidentiality to even tell their own constituents what are in those treaties. Now, that's just wrong. That's corporate control over the interests of individual citizens. Second thing is the trade resolution dispute mechanism that exists. And under that, corporations, be they U.S. corporations or be they non-U.S. corporations, they will have more power than either your local governments or the citizens who are the taxpayers in this country. And I take particular interest in that because that's really unjust and it's inequitable towards our own citizens. Now, these treaties, if we take TPP, for example, will TPP, what will it do, for example, I'm in farming, what will it do to, say, farming in Japan or farming in, say, Vietnam? You know, will that undercut the local agrarian economy like NAFTA did in Mexico? And, I mean, that's part of the reason that we have 11.5 million undocumented Mexicans and Central Americans here. We undermine the agrarian economy there. And if we look at previous precedents, be it NAFTA, be it CAFTA, which is the Caribbean Trade Agreement. If we look at the agreement with Colombia, if we look at Korea, in every case, shortly prior to signing those agreements, as well as several years afterwards, you saw unemployment rise. Now, if unemployment is going to rise, you're going to have to train these people such that they don't end up in low-wage service jobs, that they are able to support their families sustainably, and that they can expand the economy.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234, starting off with Tom in Richland Center. Tom, hi.
Yeah, hi. The question I have for your guest is, why do the Democrats insist year after year of restricting my right to keep and bear arms?
Tom, thanks for the call. So issues of gun control and Second Amendment rights, Michael.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your question, Tom. I don't really feel that the Democrats are engaged in restricting the right to bear arms. I mean, under the Second Amendment, a person has the right to bear arms. I personally own a shotgun that I use to kill either vermin or sick wildlife on my farm. And there's nothing opposed to that. There is nothing opposed by the Democrats for holding, say, for example, attack weapons or concealed carry or something like that. Now then, That may not necessarily be my position, but that's you asked the question with regard to the Democrats, and I'm attempting to answer that. I will also say, though, that if you look at these mass shootings, many of them, you're dealing with people that have mental instability, and there needs to be background checks at all points, whether it is a gun dealer or whether it is gun shows or private individuals, in order to ward out individuals like that that are mentally unstable that will kill someone.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We'll go next to Sean on the line in Madison. Sean, hi.
Hi. My question is, over the last several budgets, we've seen this excuse about debt as a reason to shrink state budgets, and it seems to be based on this fallacy that states need to be run like corporations. I'm really offended by that because states aren't corporations. Corporations are supposed to operate under the aegis of a state, and they're supposed to be beholden to the state to provide goods and services the state cannot provide. What are your feelings now? Why the Republicans seem to just keep this up and keep this up to reduce our budgets and our tax base? How do you think we can turn that around?
Sean, this is at thanks for that call, Michael. This is at the federal level you're running for now. But talk about that idea of shrinking government and using deficits as a reason to do that.
Okay, thank you, Sean. So I will approach it from two points. Yes, I am running for a federal office, not a state office, but there is some similarity. So with regard to debt, you know, what is the purpose of government? The purpose of government is to provide for the public good where private sector companies or private entities either will not or cannot provide for that. So in that sense, if you just take, for example, train lines, and I lived in Japan for 18 years or so, who runs the train lines out to the countryside? It's the government. They're money-losing enterprises. They may be money-losing enterprises, but they need to provide service to the public, and that is the public good, where private corporations or private entities either will not or cannot provide that. That's the role of government, and they need to do that. Now then, as to whether a government is to be run like a corporation or not, I don't think it is. I mean, government is not. Does it need the discipline that private corporations have? You bet it does, and that's part of the problem of the paralysis and the lack of confidence and trust that we have in government now because it's operating so inefficiently. And in final regard in that, I think it's also very important that this business discipline, not a profit motive, but a efficiently run bureaucracy be undertaken. Why? Because you have certain elements in our society and certain political parties now pushing for privatization of, be it Social Security or various public agencies, you know, outsourcing it to private entities. So if government is to provide these services, it needs to be run efficiently, and that's like a corporation, but not with the objective of profit motive or running a profit constantly.
Sean, thanks for that call. We're talking to Michael Slattery. He's a Democratic congressional candidate in Wisconsin's 6th District primary. We'll go back to our callers now with Chuck in Manitowoc. Chuck, hi.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Mike. Hey, everybody. You're just talking about how maybe there's a possibility of privatization of Social Security. And I heard you mention earlier in the program that that's something you want to get changed. One, just to give you a quick example, I've campaigned for Scott Hernig and Steve Bauer in the 27th Assembly District for the last few years. And a lot of the Democratic people are asking those questions when I'd be going door to door, and I'd say, look, all we need to do is get it out of that general relief fund and put it back into its own entity. So that way, the Social Security will still be building and it won't be getting jumped by Chuck, whenever our government wants to just take money out of there.
Chuck, thanks for the call. Michael, your approach, you mentioned the Social Security Trust Fund earlier. What would you like to see happen? What would you work for in Congress when it comes to Social Security?
Okay, I'm absolutely opposed to the privatization of Social Security, and I'll tell you very simply why. If you look at investment in mutual funds, for example, where probably more than 50% of our public has money invested, be it in 401ks or what have you, less than 15% of those funds manage to meet their targets in terms of performance. Now, if those funds that are run by professional managers, for the most part, cannot meet their investment targets, how can you expect private individuals who lack the resources, who lack the investor expertise, who lack the data to be able to analyze where that money is going? So the best way, and furthermore, many of the people that we have in retirement and coming into retirement now, they either have no or very little investment funds for their own retirement. So they cannot be playing, and the government should not be playing in the stock market with those funds. Those funds should continue to be invested in either U.S. treasuries or U.S. agencies. And that is what I would propose. Now, my last point is a little bit of a twist on this, and it's very important.
Just briefly, Michael, we're just about out of time.
Okay, so we have a shrinking labor pool. We have an expanding retirement pool. And in that, we are not going to be able to run that as a pay-as-you-go mechanism, which is what it is. It would be better if we used an annuity system, which, again, is investing in U.S. treasuries and agencies. Thank you.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, and happy to be here.
We've been talking to Michael Slattery. He's a Democratic congressional candidate in the 6th District primary. We'll hear from the other candidate in that primary, Sarah Lloyd, at this time tomorrow. That primary election is Tuesday, August 9th. And remember, whether you're talking about the presidential election, congressional elections, or local elections around the state, you can always head over to wisconsinvote.org for lots of information, recordings of candidate interviews you hear here on the Ideas Network, videos from Wisconsin Public Television as well, and a lot of just basic voter information. Again, head over to wisconsinvote.org for all your election needs.
Today is a big day for fans of role-playing games. It is Gary Gygax Day, marking the birthday of the influential co-creator of the legendary game, Dungeons & Dragons.
Gygax spent much of his life in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which was, for a long time, the headquarters of the company he co-created, the producers of Dungeons & Dragons for many years, TSR.
And according to what we've seen on social media, people might mark the day by reading his game-related publications and novels, drawing maps on graph paper, and, of course, playing Dungeons & Dragons.
Hugely influential game, of course. I think it's affected a lot of the computer games we see today, some short-lived animated series movies, and another movie that's in the early stages, another Dungeons & Dragons movie in the works. They're still signing up actors and things, so don't watch for that preview anytime soon.
I didn't realize there was a first movie, but I will say, since having kids and my husband's also a geek this way, I've learned the parlance of this. So I've decided that if I'm going to be part of this world, I want to be a wizard warrior.
Wizard warrior. Okay.
What about you?
I mean, you are kind of in real life. I'm partial to the ranger kind of character, you know, Aragorn Strider from The Lord of the Rings, which was one of the options in a sort of a non-officially licensed kind of way in Dungeons & Dragons. Well, here's the theme to that animated series of Dungeons & Dragons on Gary Gygax Day here on Central Time.